Hi everyone, and welcome back to a supplemental video for the Old Testament Survey course. This section is a supplement to the section on the book of Isaiah, and in it, we'll explore the passage of the suffering servant in more detail. We'll mention the context of the passage and the identity of the servant, but we'll spend most of this section looking at the flow and message of this passage, and then its application in the New Testament. First, a reminder of the context of this passage. It comes in the third portion of Isaiah, where God is comforting his people by reminding them that he is the only God and that he is working out his purpose to restore them and display his glory to the nations. And in the midst of this, God gives Isaiah a series of four oracles that describe someone called my servant. In these passages, the mission of the servant is elaborated in several ways: to be a light to the nations, to be a covenant for God's people Israel, to establish justice, to show that Yahweh alone is God, to restore Israel, and to be obedient to God, among other things. And then the passage we're looking at is the fourth and last of these servant oracles, in Isaiah chapter 52:13 through 53:12. Now let's talk about the identity of the servant. When God, through Isaiah, uses the term my servant, to whom is he referring? Now, the immediate reaction of many Christians is to say, well, Jesus, of course. And that's not a bad answer at all. But I want to qualify it a bit. Remember that we need to first read the Old Testament on its own terms, before Jesus. Then we see Jesus in light of the Old Testament, and then we see the Old Testament in light of Jesus. So I would agree, yes, Jesus fulfills the suffering servant passage, no doubt. But we need to ask, what is it that he fulfills? We need to ask what this passage meant to Isaiah's time before Jesus was known, so that we can better understand what it is that Jesus fulfilled, and so better know Jesus. So, who did the people in Isaiah's time think of when Isaiah referred to my servant? Now, scholars have proposed many possibilities. Some say it might be the nation of Israel. Some suggest it refers to Isaiah himself. Some say it points to the Persian king Cyrus, and others leave it kind of ambiguous with some unidentified mystery figure. Now, some of these suggestions work for certain verses in the servant passages, but not in others. So scholars still argue about the identity of the servant with no clear consensus. Now, I think a helpful approach is to look back to the larger Old Testament context to supply what the first hearers would have thought when they heard this term, my servant. See, the term my servant had already been used many times in the Old Testament. For instance, God calls Moses my servant, and Abraham my servant, and David my servant, and others. In these examples, it means the one who does God's will, and therefore has a great impact on his nation in this time period. So Isaiah's hearers would have heard the one who does God's will, the one who serves God. And they would have heard these passages as a description of what God's will for that time was, what God wanted his obedient one to do. In other words, I would like to suggest that we see this passage not so much as a description in order to figure out the identity of the servant, but we should see it as an invitation to obey God in the manner that this passage elaborates. In other words, it might be helpful to see this passage as a job description. And it's challenging the people of Isaiah's time to see who's going to take up this role, who will be obedient to the Lord. In other words, it doesn't invite the question, who's he talking about, as much as it invites the question, Who should be doing this? Well, the king should, and the priest should, and the prophet should. As a matter of fact, all of God's people should in some way seek to faithfully fulfill this calling to obey and please God in this way. So it brings the challenge, am I being obedient in this? So in this sense, it does refer to Israel. Israel as a whole should have done these things, but they didn't. They should have acted as an intermediary to the nations on behalf of the Lord. And of course, each leader in Israel and each individual Israelite should have taken up this burden. But in Isaiah's time, no one seemed to have stepped up. And therefore, this mission was left unfulfilled in Isaiah's time, but it should have been. It was a call to be this kind of person to serve and please the Lord. So now, let's work through the passage itself. I will trust you to follow along in your Bible as we work through this passage, instead of taking the time to read the entire passage to you. The passage is broken into five sections. First, the servant is a contradiction. Second, the servant appears insignificant. Third, the servant suffers redemptively. Fourth, the servant suffers innocently. And fifth, the servant is vindicated by his success. Now let's look at each section in turn. In the last four verses of chapter 52, the servant is described in what I can best call a contradiction. See, the way he's described makes the servant seem like an oxymoron. See, on the one hand, he's said to prosper, be very exalted. And yet, very next verse, it says people are appalled at him. And he's said to be deformed and unrecognizable. And the reaction of the first hearers, as well as many modern ones, is, well, that makes no sense. How can that be? You know, people are usually deformed and disfigured because something went horribly wrong. So how can such a person be prosperous and successful? And nations and kings will be startled to silence by the servant. And the reason is given that they will see the things that were not recounted to them, and they will understand the things they did not hear. Well, notice that this is a very unusual thing to say, even impossible that this would happen. How could they understand something that they did not hear? But I hope you also notice that this is the opposite of the blindness and the deafness we saw earlier in Isaiah as a punishment for idolatry. That God's work in his people is to open blind eyes and unstop deaf ears. And this transitions into the next section. And in this section, Isaiah points out that people did not recognize the servant because he defied their expectations. And the servant seemed to be insignificant by the normal standards of judgment. And it starts with a challenge. Who has believed the report? And to whom has the strength of Yahweh been revealed? And then the rest of the second section describes what we would call an insignificant loser. He's like a small plant, like a shoot just springing out of dry ground. You know, think, when was the last time that you stopped to look at a plant just starting to poke through the ground and you said to yourself, wow, that's a really impressive plant? Now, after it's grown into a huge tree or produces beautiful flowers or delicious fruit, maybe you might say, yeah, that's a great plant. But typically not when it's first starting out. But that's how people saw the servant. Unimpressive. He did not have a noteworthy form or outward splendor. Nothing in him caused us to desire him. Rather, he was despised and abandoned. He was a man of suffering who knows sickness and being despised to the point that people look away. See, the servant absolutely was not respected or held in regard, but rather seemed insignificant. But as often with God, looks can be deceiving. Remember, God doesn't look on the outside, but at the heart. And remember that Israel was not an impressive nation when God chose them, but God made them special by his choosing them. And that brings us into the next section, which shows that the servant's suffering was not insignificant, but it actually accomplished salvation. Because a servant suffered redemptively. Now, in this section, notice the contrast between the pronouns. Isaiah emphasizes the back and forth between he and us. He carried our sickness. He bore our sufferings. We assumed him to be stricken, afflicted by God and humiliated, but he was wounded for our transgressions, crushed for our iniquity. The punishment for our peace was on him. And by his wounds, we are healed. All of us have wandered away like sheep. Everyone has turned to their own way. But Yahweh has caused him to be hurt for the iniquity of all of us. Do you hear this back and forth? It emphasizes the substitutionary nature of the servant's suffering. He suffered in place of those who deserved the suffering. And we received the rewards that he deserved. The servant suffers redemptively by offering himself in the place of those who were not able to save themselves, freely, graciously submitting to that suffering so that others would benefit from it. And not only does a servant suffer redemptively, but the next section emphasizes that he suffered innocently. As a matter of fact, he can only suffer redemptively because he was innocent. Remember that all sacrifices in the Old Testament must be spotless. But this section concentrates on the manner in which the servant suffered. When he was oppressed and afflicted, he did not even open his mouth in protest. He was silent, like a sheep led to slaughter. By oppression and judgment he was taken, and no one can speak of his descendants because he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people, the violent blows were upon him, and his grave was with the wicked ones, and his death with the rich. Even though he did not do violence, and there was no deceit in his mouth. You see, Isaiah emphasizes that the servant was innocent and undeserving in all of this suffering. But also, he did not accuse, argue, or fight back against this punishment. Now, of course, we would expect that an innocent man would protest his innocence. Hey, I don't deserve this. But God's servant was willing even to forgo this. Not only was he willing to give up his right to be considered important, to become insignificant, and not only was he willing to undergo suffering, but he was also willing to give up his right to be treated fairly. And he was willing to give up his reputation to be considered, wrongly considered, to be a criminal. In order that his suffering in these ways would benefit others and please God. Now, that's quite a tall order. And you might be thinking, well, why would anybody agree to this? And that's a really good question. Especially if we stop reading this passage right there. But Isaiah goes on and gives some great reasons in the next section. But before we get there, I need to emphasize that no matter what, it takes trust in God for God's servant to do something like this. And we all need to regularly remind ourselves that God is trustworthy, no matter what he asks us to do. If he asks us to do it, it will be for our long-term benefit, and we'll be glad we did, even if we don't understand it, even if he does not fully explain his reasons. Now back to the servant passage. In the last section, God does give some reasons. It starts by saying that Yahweh delighted to crush him and make him suffer because his life is an atonement for guilt. See, this draws on the sacrificial system that we saw in Leviticus, that a guilt offering would atone for sin and the sinner would be forgiven. And this passage calls the servant's suffering a guilt offering. But in this case, the offering was not an animal, but the servant himself. And then we see the vindication and prosperity of the servant. He will see his offspring and lengthen his days, and the desire of Yahweh will prosper in his hand, and he will be satisfied from the toil of his soul. Well, how can this be? A few verses earlier, we saw that he was cut off and he had no descendants. But now he sees his offspring and long life and satisfaction. Well, what changed? Well, only God can bring life from death and new life from barrenness. And not only that, but the servant is assured that his ministry was effective. He will make many righteous by their knowing him. He will bear their iniquity. And the end result is that the servant, who was thought to be insignificant, will be recognized to be great. God will apportion him reward among the great, among mighty ones. He will get his share because he poured out his soul to death and he was counted with transgressors. He bore the sins of many and he interceded for transgressors. In other words, because the servant successfully completed his redemptive suffering, God will reward him. He will restore his reputation and make everyone see the greatness hidden behind his apparent insignificance. And everyone will see the innocence and grace hidden behind his apparent guilt and punishment. The servant was willing to become low, to suffer, and to be thought insignificant, but God made him exalted and proved him to be significant. See, this answers the apparent contradiction from the beginning of the servant song. The servant is exalted by being insignificant. The servant is rewarded by suffering. The servant is satisfied by being emptied. And the servant finds life by giving his soul to death. This is the meaning of the suffering servant passage in its original historical setting in Isaiah's time. And like I said, this is an invitation for all of Israel to trust God and be willing to suffer to bring God's message of salvation to all the nations. However, no one in Israel stepped up to do this. Remember, the Old Testament is a record of Israel's failure to fulfill God's purposes. So we need to go to the New Testament to find the ultimate servant who does fulfill this passage. So now let's turn to the New Testament and see how they apply the passage. Now, this Isaiah passage is used in a number of different ways in the New Testament. And the most surprising way that the suffering servant passage was used in the New Testament is as an apologetic to prove that Jesus is the Messiah. You see, before Jesus, the idea of the suffering servant had never been connected with the idea of the Messiah. You know, they had Messiah passages and then the suffering servant passage, but nobody ever thought that they might be referring to the same person, same reality. And I hope you can see why. See, the Messiah was the heir of the Davidic kingship, He was to be a ruler and a warrior. Therefore, it's unthinkable that the Messiah would suffer and die. And that's why Paul says that Christ crucified is a stumbling block and foolishness to many. See, the Messiah could never be crucified. The Messiah is a winner, not a loser. And anyone who's crucified is cursed by definition. And of course, that's why Paul has to turn that on its head. And he argues that Christ became a curse for us to release us from the curse of the law. That is, Paul argues that the Messiah was cursed, not because he deserved a curse, but because he took our curse upon himself. And the Jews of Jesus' day, and our day as well, argued that the fact that he was crucified argues that he could not have been the Messiah. But the New Testament writers, they respond that according to the suffering servant passage, he was the Messiah precisely because he suffered. Because his suffering was innocent and redemptive. And because Jesus, the Messiah, was fulfilling the role of the suffering servant. So many of the times this passage is quoted in the New Testament, it is an apologetic for Christ fulfilling the servant Messiah role, especially in his passion. For instance, in Matthew 8, verse 17, in the context of Jesus healing various diseases and infirmities, Matthew quotes, "He took our infirmities and carried our diseases." See, Jesus brings the benefit of healing, which, by the way, not limited to physical healing, but does include physical healing, by taking people's suffering onto himself. And that's an important part of his ministry. Then in Luke 22:37, in the context that Jesus is about to be arrested, they're in the garden, Jesus quotes, "And he was numbered with the transgressors." By quoting this verse, Jesus is pointing out that he and his followers would be mistakenly considered criminals and worthy of punishment, and they would be pursued and persecuted as such. Now, of course, this was about to happen to Jesus in the garden, leading to his suffering on the cross, but he's also warning that his disciples should expect the same kind of treatment that he was about to receive. And then next is John chapter 12, verse 38. In the context of the unbelief of the Jews who were rejecting Jesus, John quotes, "Who has believed our message?" Even after seeing the miracles, they still would not believe. And John uses this quote to prove that the Jews were like the idolaters in Isaiah's day. They were unable to see the reality of Jesus because they had been blinded, just like the people in Isaiah's day. But it also points to Jesus as the one fulfilling the servant role. Then in Acts chapter 8, verses 32 and 33, in the context, an Ethiopian is reading this passage from Isaiah, and he asks Philip for help figuring out who the passage is talking about. The Ethiopian read, "He was led like a sheep to the slaughter, and as a lamb before the shearer is silent, so he did not open his mouth. In his humiliation, he was deprived of justice. Who can speak of his descendants? For his life was taken from the earth." And we're told that Philip begins from this passage and tells him the good news of Jesus. We're not told exactly what Philip said, but we can kind of guess that he shows that Jesus' death and resurrection fulfilled the mission of the servant by suffering redemptively and innocently as a guilt offering on the cross and being vindicated and rewarded by the resurrection. And so Philip proclaimed this salvation in Christ. Then there are also a few verses that draw attention to the suffering servant passage in order to speak of the missionary calling of the church. For instance, in Romans 10:16, in the context of Paul arguing for sending missionaries and supporting missionaries to preach Christ, he quotes, "Who has believed our message?" And he makes the point in this verse that not everyone believes. There is a need for God's work in convincing hearts and opening blind eyes. And there's also a need for human preachers. Then in Romans chapter 15, verse 21, in the context of Paul's desire to preach in unreached areas, he quotes, "Those who were not told about him will see, and those who have not heard will understand." See, Paul wants to be instrumental in the fulfillment of this passage for people in specific areas he's referring to, that they would come to knowledge of the servant, Jesus, and experience the rewards, the results of his redemptive sacrifice. Now, there's not a direct quote from the suffering servant passage, but the Gospels make a point to emphasize that Jesus was silent at his trial. He did not fight back or complain when he was whipped, abused, and crucified. And this restraint was shocking to the people who were inflicting this suffering. And then one more passage I want to discuss, which extensively quotes and makes indirect reference to the suffering servant passage in many different ways. And that is 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 18 through 25. Now in this passage, notice how Peter draws parallels between the suffering servant passage and Jesus. Just a reminder of the outline of the Isaiah passage. The servant is a contradiction. The servant appears insignificant. The servant suffers redemptively, the servant suffers innocently, and the servant is vindicated. Now, Peter's readers would have known about Jesus' suffering and humiliation, his rejection by his own people. And in this passage, Peter emphasized that Jesus suffered innocently. He committed no sin, and no deceit was found in his mouth. When they hurled insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. And Jesus suffered redemptively. Peter states that Christ suffered for you. And he himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, so that we might die to sins. And by his wounds you have been healed. For you were like sheep going astray, but now you have returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. See, Peter proclaims that Jesus' sacrifice brought his readers back to God. And Jesus was vindicated. This is implied when Peter says he entrusted himself to the one who judges justly. And Peter's readers would have known about the resurrection and exaltation of Jesus. So Peter draws parallels between the suffering servant and Jesus. But notice that Peter also takes this one step further, which is also clearly based on the suffering servant passages. In this passage, Peter's giving instructions to slaves who were likely suffering under unjust masters. And he draws parallels between the suffering servant passage and Jesus and the experience and the instructions for these servants. He's already told them earlier in the book that they are God's elect, even though some of them were slaves. They themselves were a contradiction, like the servant, and they seemed insignificant by their society's standards. They were slaves, subject to masters, even harsh masters, some of them. Yet Peter told them to submit. The specific reason is because Jesus left them an example to follow. First, that they were to suffer innocently. He says it's no credit if you're beaten for doing wrong and you endure it, but it is commendable if you suffer for doing good and you endure it, because then you are following in Jesus' footsteps. And I also think the implication from the wider context in 1 Peter is that they also can suffer redemptively. Their suffering is not a guilt offering that'll purchase atonement like Jesus. But in 1 Peter, they're repeatedly given the hope that their masters will see their good deeds and glorify God. That by doing good, they would silence those that accused them. And history has shown many cases of people being converted by noticing the godly behavior of Christians during their suffering. And lastly, it is very clear from the wider context of 1 Peter that Peter promises those who follow the servant pattern of innocent, redemptive suffering will be vindicated. They're commanded not to repay evil with evil or insult with insult, and they're promised that they will inherit a blessing. And they're commanded to rejoice that you participate in the sufferings of Christ so that you may also be overjoyed when his glory is revealed. Throughout 1 Peter, they are promised if they're faithful in suffering, they will experience glory. 1 Peter is full of many more promises of vindication and redemptive fruit for those who are godly in the midst of suffering. Just like the suffering servant, just like Jesus, so the people in 1 Peter's time. Therefore, we see in this passage in 1 Peter, not only that Jesus absolutely fulfills the suffering servant passage by being God's ultimate servant Messiah, but also that Christ's people are to fulfill in our smaller way what Christ did in a large way. We can look back on Christ as the one who became as nothing and suffered to purchase life for us. So we should trust him completely. And we notice that he was exalted to the highest place, and so we should rejoice in him. And we can also look for ways in which we, in our situation, we can fulfill the servant calling. We can be okay with seeming insignificant, with living outside of the spotlight. And we can allow ourselves to be inconvenienced and even to suffer undeservedly for the sake of others, because we know that God will be pleased with our service and he will repay. Okay, that is the overview of the suffering servant passage and its significance for the New Testament. I hope this has been both informative and inspirational. And I pray that you will trust God enough to take up his invitation to follow in the suffering servant's footsteps, to die to yourself and therefore find life. In the next section, we'll look at the book of Jeremiah. Thanks for watching.